Welcome to this episode of the Fight for Sight podcast. I am over the moon to have the National Clinical Director for Eye Care, Medical Director for Moorfields Eye Hospital, Louisa Wickham, joining me today. Hello, Louisa.
Hello, Keith. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you so much. I know how precious time is at these difficult times in the NHS. The Fight for Sight podcast, as people will know from listening to other episodes, have been looking for a way of creating a conversation around eye research and the patient experience to take our system forward and to find ways for the investment that we make as a charity and the kind of initiatives and shared investments that we make to be really valuable to the impact on patients and the way that patients' lives are affected by sight loss, but also the way that we work together to chin to treatments for eye disease forward and to have more to say to patients as practicing clinicians such as yourself, Louisa, have to say to patients in the chair when you find that they have a disease. For me personally, I didn't choose to go into the world of ophthalmology. It was my DNA and genetics that gave me the world of ophthalmology as someone with retinitis pigmentosa and a number of conditions that are associated with that. So whilst I'm not here by choice, I'm really impressed by the people that are here by choice. And I wonder, Louisa, if we could start by you saying a bit about what happened in your life that drew you towards being a clinician and working in the world of ophthalmology.
Thanks, Keith. I think many people who have gone through sort of medical training will understand when I say that ophthalmology wasn't something that I initially even really understood or knew much about, because when you're training as a doctor, actually, it's something that relatively little time is spent on compared to the rest of your medical education. But it was only after I qualified and I had a real interest in both the surgical management of disease and the medical management of disease that one of the consultants I was working with suggested, well, ophthalmology is a great mix of whole patient treatment, in the sense that often we think about ophthalmology as conditions of eyes, but actually the eyes really are the window to the rest of your body. And if you are an ophthalmologist, you need to understand not just about the eyes, but how they reflect what's going on in the rest of the body. And actually, it's a much broader subject than people would ever imagine. And also, there are very few subspecialties where you are able to treat a whole wide range of diverse people in terms of age groups. We treat children, we treat elderly patients, right the way through. And actually, many other specialties, they get quite narrow in terms of the people that you come into contact with. So I started ophthalmology, and to be honest, I never looked back. I just found it so fascinating, the way in which you could tell so much about a patient through their eyes. And more lastly, became very interested in retinal disease, particularly diabetic retinopathy and trauma, which is why I then became a retinal specialist. And that's sort of my journey through into ophthalmology. But it's as part of that, I then really became interested in the ability of clinicians to impact the quality of care that patients get, the patient experience through their interaction with how pathways are set up. And that led me to take an interest in medical management and leadership through further education, but also particularly focusing on perceptions of quality and how we improve quality when we're delivering eye care.
So it feels very much in that there's a definite connection between your role as a clinician and the experience of that. I guess that's, would we call that the cold face of the system, that connection to patient and the clinical judgments that you would make, and managerial leadership decisions about how the system itself gets shaped. I wonder if you could say a bit about the importance of you still being a clinician while you're taking on this leadership role as a National Clinical Director for Eye Care.
Being a clinician is what gives me the real impetus to improve and continue to improve the patient experience and the patient pathway, because I'm there listening to patients, understanding the difficulties they've had, not just in their experience of their condition and how we've managed it, but also the whole pathway of how they came to being diagnosed, how they then entered the system of eye care, and how they felt as a patient, and how we have done both from an organizational perspective as my doctor within Moorfield, but also in a systems perspective about how they were treated, how they were diagnosed, the struggles that some patients have had to obtain a diagnosis and then to obtain the information following the diagnosis. Interaction, I think, for me, is fundamental to my understanding of where I would like to see eye care go and how we drive transformation and pathway development, because it keeps me in touch with what patients are experiencing. And I can see closer hand the impact and effects of some of the things we do, certainly in my role as a medical director at Moorfields. Yeah. I can then very quickly see the impacts of those changes and also where we might need to tweak or change them. And I suppose fundamentally my passion is for treating patients and always has been. So it's a real vital part of what I do.
So, I mean, and you'll forgive me for this, to take you back to your early career as an ophthalmologist, what it must, because very many of our listeners will be patients themselves. Mm. Just what, I mean, just as a non-clinician, you know, the thought of being there with someone with their eyes dilated and, you know, the lights and flashes and all the things that you do. I know what it feels like to be a patient in that situation. And, you know, there's good and bad experiences as there are in any system with that. But I wonder what it would have felt like for you starting out in ophthalmology to be, you know, to have that human being next to you where you're looking for an understanding to try and impact and improve their experience of, you know, of sight loss. Whether, you know, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, how the human connection felt alongside them as a clinical, you know, I was going to use the word specimen, then that's not what I mean. as a clinical problem to resolve. Yeah. Apologies for that.
You know what? I think it's one of the real privileges, isn't it, of being in the healthcare profession in whatever sphere you're in, is that real privilege of being part of a patient's journey, of being part of that ability to help patients in their journey. And there is a real... So for me, I suppose, there's an aspect of... The thing that really drives me in terms of patient care is really trying to improve the quality of what patients get, and also to understand in that patient journey that sometimes in an organization that is as big as the NHS, to produce personalized care that is empathic with the needs of patients can be very difficult. And I suppose I feel my driver is about trying to understand that. So, for example, with patients with diabetic retinopathy, these patients often have, you know, multiple other system disease, which means they're constantly going to appointments in different hospitals across the patch. They feel often that their whole life has been revolved around their medical treatment. And then we are surprised when they don't end up turning up to appointments because they've either got a clash of appointments they couldn't tell us, or they've been ill. And yet sometimes that system is not forgiving about that. And so I suppose for me, what I feel is a real privilege as a doctor, and interest for me, is to try and see how on that journey, that connection with the patient, to create that understanding with a patient about the importance of why they come to see you, but also linking that with an empathy to understand what it's like for them. And I suppose to your point about the bond between a patient and a doctor, it's about getting that mutual understanding of what you see as in the patient's best interest, but then making sure that that is also what how the patient sees it, and to connect those two things, because that is so fundamental to how patients view their journey and how likely patients are to continue with their treatment when at times with the conditions we treat, there's some really dark times for patients when they will experience, hopefully, temporary sight loss as a result of some of the things we do for them. But in some cases, you know, permanent sight loss as a result of their interactions with the medical profession because of their underlying disease. So there's a real journey there that's about trust and about connection. That, for me, is the ultimate about why you're a doctor, but can be very challenging in a large system such as the NHS.
And I think some of your comments there, Louisa, particularly to patients that have been through the system, I think will be, you know, if not reassuring, because these are complex and difficult arrangements, it shows that, as I say, that human connection in a relationship that is, you know, is profoundly about preserving sight. And we know ourselves from the work that we're doing in planning for our charitable investment over the next 2 or 3 years that patients are telling us that there are kind of two profound questions that occur for them at the point that yourself and colleagues are telling them that they've got, you know, eye disease that perhaps can't currently be treated or that has a difficult prognosis. And those are, you know, in one part to the, I think, the point that you're making there, which is, you know, how do I live my life, you know, and those connections and the onward journey of a patient with a difficult prognosis are critical. But the other part of it as well is, you know, how can you stop this happening to me? Or you know, in the cases of, you know, of a parent with a child, you know, can you stop this happening to my child? And certainly from a, you know, the charity sector point of view and Fight for Sight work is really looking at how we kind of, you know, fuse that authentic response for people. It's not unusual in other conditions for people to simply say, can you stop it happening? How am I going to live with this? Sure. And there's, you know, there's a sense, there's a little bit of a separation of that in relation to, you know, where an eye disease, you know, materially becomes a disability for people. So I'm going to loop back, I think, to some of those, you know, the implications of what you were saying there in terms of support and the value of sight going forward. But first of all, it'd be useful to explore, you know, your thoughts. I think principally as, you know, the National Clinical Director for Eye Care, not to define you by one of your roles, but we obviously, Fight for Sight exists to invest money into the discovery and development of treatments. And we're also interested in preventing the loss of eyesight. And, you know, I'm very, very conscious that the money available from the charity sector, you know, must, you know, our organization and others is pretty small when you compare it to other disease areas and, you know, standout ones around dementia, Alzheimer's, diabetes, heart, cancer, et cetera. So there's about, it depends how you slice the cake with these, but with commitments in, there's about 15, 16 million pounds a year going in to that from the charity sector, which if you look at the sector as a whole is tiny. But it's also true if you look at government investment. And if you take kind of, you know, stats up to the point that COVID and the pandemic opened out and put the system under such incredible pressure, there was around, well, it's £9.60, but let's call it a tenner for shakes, going into research related to patients with eye disease. Whereas if you take, I mean, if we pick dementia as an example, there's around £97. We could call that 100 if we want to round it up. Yeah. So you've got quite a big differential there, which I think is, you know, it's a stat that only means something if you look at it in the context of ophthalmology as one of the biggest outpatient functions, you know, in the NHS. And then, in, you know, look at it in cash terms, you know, there are, it's about 1.5% of the total spend on medical research, you know, from the government and public bodies is going into eyes. So you've got that, you know, what, you know, a lay person, which I sort of proudly claim myself to be, despite my lived expertise, looks like a, you know, a disparity. And I'm not sure framing it in that way necessarily takes us forward. And I'm just interested, I think, about what routes you can see, not just for the money, because I think it's also about the progress of, you know, of research. And I'm conscious there are other players in this field other than the government. So it'd just be interesting to, you know, to hear your, you know, your view from your perspective at NHSE, and then perhaps personally from more fields as well, about what journey we might take together to address that if it's a problem.
I think it's a challenge, isn't it? It's funding of research has always been a challenge, but I think even more so in the current climate. I think it's important to recognize the huge impact that the charitable sector has in this. That, you know, with Fight for Sight, Moorfields Eye Charity, Macular Society, RNIB, there are a number of organizations that have a huge part to play in not just the raising of funds for research, but actually to raise the profile of eye disease and the education of the population about eye disease in general. Because I think for many, the perception is that eye disease is predominantly cataract, because I think that's what gets discussed most in the context of ophthalmology. And then to some extent, macular degeneration and glaucoma, which are huge volume specialties. And I think there is generally not as much awareness, I would say, both in the public and in policymakers of the impact of eye disease on the population. So if we look at the impact of sight loss on the population, is in the region of 25 billion per year in cost of sight loss to the country and you put it in that context, and you suddenly realize the importance of research in addressing that. And I think the research is used that in the broadest sense. So I think there's obviously additional funding that comes in through industry, through eye care, particularly from the pharma industry, which is also crucial. But there is also increasing recognition that some of the real impactful research that can happen in eye care now is also about how we organize ourselves. So, for example, some of the more recent grants that we had looked for at Moorfields have been looking at things like diagnostic hubs. How do we organize ourselves such that we can be more impactful in delivering eye care to patients, particularly in this post-COVID era where large numbers of people are waiting on waiting lists? How can we be impactful not only just in researching the disease condition and its treatment, but also the organization of resources such that we treat the most patients in the most impactful way? So I think going forward, the way in which we all collaborate together to support each other in raising the awareness of eye care, raising the awareness to the population such that when we campaign for funding for charitable funds, when we ask patients to become involved in research, they're much more aware of the potential impact of those things.
Yeah, and I know I'm particularly aware at Moorfields that you have the Rome hub for attracting people for trials, etc. And, you know, it's certainly one of the things that, you know, from Fight for Sight, we have to be very considered in the way we make investment. But obviously, you know, it's in our interest to get that connection right so that patients perhaps that are being told, well, you know, there's nothing we can do for you. And I'm sure, you know, most ophthalmologists will try and couch that in a way that's, you know, as positive as it can be, that it's not necessarily the end of the clinical journey in relation to trials, and there are opportunities for people to participate. It strikes me as well that there's not really, I mean, this is, you know, in part this is from personal experience, and I'm speaking as a layperson, that it's, you know, there's very much, you know, a requirement for the patient to, you know, to find their way to the information beyond the initial condition information that an ophthalmologist is able to provide with the time available with the patient. You know, and I think there is, you know, there's definitely a job to be done there in terms of, you know, the way that the way the charities such as Fight for Sight set themselves up to make sure that communications are improved and that our efforts are in tandem with, you know, the development of the system. I think, you know, I wonder if you have a view as well about the role that the clinical practitioners could play further in the actual conduct of research. I know we've noticed in the grants that we've made over the last 3 years, and we've got about £8.5 million out in grants at the moment, that there are, you know, the vast majority of people are specifically working, you know, in research out of clinic, and there are noticeable examples of people within that are in clinic. And I wondered if you had a view about the way that the system works to encourage ophthalmologists to, you know, to consider contributing and being involved in research themselves.
Yes, it is a difficult tension, I think, in terms of clinical work and research work, and particularly when we take it out of the arena of lab-based working and talk about clinical research. And as someone who did a research degree myself, I can really understand some of the difficulties of setting up research trials, setting up protocols, and finding the time to apply for grants and then putting them into practice. I think that is a real challenge. I think it's and how we support clinicians with good ideas and how we bring them together so that we can, you know, help use the resources that we have and the experience that we have to take good ideas and let them become, you know, fully developed into trials that then impact patient care, I think is a real area of focus that we certainly try to look at Moorfields as well. I think the other thing that increasingly we also need to that we have really become aware of is how we take patients on that journey as well, about how we educate patients that are entering trials or are entering into more innovative practice that might not necessarily be in a trial. How do we do that in a way that protects the patient who may be in a vulnerable position at the time of diagnosis, who wants to experience something new, but needs to also fully understand that with innovation and with research comes that risk of being the first person to try something. How do we bring patients on that journey to help them want to be part of trials and innovation, but also that we support them appropriately, that we fully inform them about what's involved? And I think that is the real, you know, the real challenge when you're doing research is to find the ideas, to then bring the patients with you and to make sure that they're fully aware of what they are volunteering for. And then really making sure that everything is communicated back to people who took part in trials and more broadly so that the impact of that trial can really be realized. And I think there are so many, there are sort of multiple points on that journey, aren't there, where you can see how those challenges arise. But encouraging clinicians, I think clinicians desperately want to do research and desperately want to move things forward. It's then how we provide them with the space and support to do that in a way that is safe, effective, makes best use of resources. And also to some extent, that when we look at funding for research, that we look at the broad piece. And I think that's where collaboration is so important. You know, we recently did a heat map to look at where were we investing in research and were we not investing everything in one condition? How were we making sure that when we invest in research, that actually we can notice if there are areas where we're not necessarily seeing as many new ideas come forward, and how can we then put our resources to encourage clinicians and scientists to then take an interest in areas which may have been underrepresented in research? And I think that's also part of the challenge, isn't it, when we're trying to encourage research is to make sure that we fairly represent all of the eye service.
And you know, looping back to that point I made about the two questions of point of diagnosis, can you stop this happening, and you know, how do I live my life? I building on what you're saying there, I think there's in the can you stop this happening space, there is you know, how do we build better systems of better accessible systems given the nature of the condition for people to understand more about their condition, more about the progress of the science and the context in a way that you know enables optimism where it's appropriate, but not false hope. And I think, you know, the point about question, you know, the second thing that people ask, which is how do I live my life? I think it's a very, you know, from personal experience, and also I think from, you know, the evidence that's showing us as we build our investment strategy, is that it's an incredibly intense, affecting moment in time, or the immediate aftermath as people get a diagnosis. And, again, you'll forgive me for the layperson's characterization, but it feels a little bit like if you have an injury that, you know, would require you to have, you know, prosthetics or to learn to walk differently or those sorts of things, the clinicians, you know, have a button to press, you know, to refer people to, you know, rehabilitation and, you know, other clinical assessment. It does feel sometimes from the patient point of view that there is, you know, I'm sure it's felt by ophthalmologists, there's not really many places that you can send people once they've got a diagnosis of, you know, an eye condition that's either going to degenerate in the long term or they're not going to recover sight. And I wonder if you could say a bit, and I guess, you know, Louisa, not to ask you an unfair question, but again, it's about your hopes personally, but also as a national clinical director for eye care, about how we might, you know, improve the circumstances for those patients. But I think also it's about, you know, building the system so that it can accommodate you. For people.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. I think traditionally the way in which we have organized ourselves to support patients and to put that as a critical part of our pathway is not as evolved as I would like to see. I think we often impart really very upsetting and life critical information to patients in clinics. And the support structure around them is, there's a huge range when you see different clinics, the degree of support structures they have around them for patients. And one of the things we're certainly working on as part of the transformation pathways that we're putting in place is to really look at the patient information and support at the time of diagnosis being really a key part of how we organize the system, so that it is really integrated into the whole pathway. At the moment, it feels like it's a slightly separate add-on that's on the side. And if you're lucky enough to be in a position or an organization where that is a fully formed process, you get access to it. But if you're not, you might not. And also understanding that the ways in which we impart support and also patient education need to evolve to kind of reflect how education has evolved and how people access information has evolved a lot over the years. And so using a mixture of media from personal one-to-one with our ECLO support services to using video consultations to using patient education information and videos and how we then allow patients to get to receive education, but then to ask questions and to have a dialogue with the clinicians, with our extended nurse practitioners and specialist nurses and charitable sector. And also we have huge support from the voluntary sector in terms of, you know, the support that patients get at the time that they're in clinic. So we're very fortunate to have the Moorfields Friends, who are volunteers who handhold and support patients as they go through the process. And we're extremely lucky to have that service in the hospital. And I think patients find it, you know, very, very supportive and very helpful. And so how do we incorporate that more as a routine part of what patients can expect when they come to a clinic? So there is a lot, I think, we can do. And the support that we get from our charitable partners is absolutely key in that, because patients need to feel that there are a number of different avenues that they can access for help and support. And I certainly think that it's an area where we need to spend more attention, more focus.
Well, I can testify through three generations of my family that the volunteers at Moorfields are extraordinary people, and they definitely make a difference. So that's, there's some evidence for you to substantiate.
No, honestly, I couldn't run my service without them. They're a fantastic group of people.
Interesting, you know, what you're saying there about different channels of communicating, engaging, involving patients, because we're 15 years out from the first iPhone, and smart technology, digital technology, you know, people of my generation, not to give my, you know, age away, but, you know, have had a good chunk of their working life, with these incredible devices in our hands. Given that, I guess, the bulk of the population and that are impacted by eye disease tend to be older, you know, at scale. And so at the moment, those people are less likely to have had, you know, sight and digital technology as normal life. But that's obviously going to change over the next, 10 years as it becomes, ubiquitous, really, that everyone had some access to that. And I just wondered if that informs some of your thinking as well, because obviously for now, digital can't solve everything, but you would imagine over time that there's huge potential as that, you know, becomes the majority of the population, including older people.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because I would agree with that. But then there are also real pockets of people who are in that post-retirement age who have now become much more digitally literate than perhaps we thought before. And I think COVID's changed that remarkably. I mean, you know, for many, that was the way they would have communicated with grandparents and parents. It's through digital media. And I think that has caused an increase in sort of comfort with digital media. But absolutely, I think digital exclusion, not just by age, but by ethnicity, by eyesight. And as you know, Keith, you know, there's a lot of evidence to say that people with sight loss are much more likely to suffer from digital exclusion because of the difficulties of keeping up to date with software and all that kind of stuff. It takes longer to become more confident with those things. So particularly with sight loss, we have to be very mindful of the risks of digital exclusion. And how do we produce services that allow those who want to do it digitally to access it? How do we support those to access digital services? So, for example, we've been using a concept of digital pods where we patients in the clinic can access digital media with support from people in the clinic through a digital pod. So, there are ways in which we can use those to support patients if they don't want to use it at home. But you're absolutely right. And I think we've got to be very careful that we use digital media to enable care. It's not a replacement for care. So when we're designing systems, we need to make sure that they are a support mechanism. But actually, for many patients, particularly with distressing use that interaction, that one-to-one interaction or person-to-person interaction still remains a very key part of what they need and want.
Yeah, and again, very familiar from the evidence that we're picking up, that I think the point about the uptake of digital tech during COVID is very valid. I think the differentials that you point to there, and just in terms of the ability to afford it, aside from anything else, with the impact of sight loss are big. And you know, somehow this is an intimately human experience, and the superpower that I believe those of us that have the eye disease and make it through to employment and to live full lives is really building the confidence. And at those points of diagnosis, I think the evidence shows that it's the impact on confidence, and I think probably a sense of patience, because they don't have any solutions to how they might progress without sight, because we live in such a visual world. And it's a difficult time. Just to close our conversation, Louisa, and again, we're very grateful for the time you've spent today. I wondered if you could say a little bit, again, to play on your role as the National Clinical Director for Eye Care, about what you feel, is optimistic about in the coming years for the system, and perhaps also, areas where you think we need to place a lot more attention.
I have to say, I've been so impressed by the enthusiasm of everyone I've met in each sort of part of the eye care pathway for transformation, for thinking about and wanting to consider how we might do things differently in order to address the significant challenges we have with eye care. And those challenges pre-existed COVID. I think, many of us who've worked in the eye care sector will appreciate that before COVID, waiting lists were becoming more challenging, demand was becoming more challenging. So I think, for me, it's hugely encouraging that that was recognized by the formation of the National Clinical Director role. And I've spent most of the time so far just listening to what people are experiencing, what the blockers are, what the enablers are, what can we learn, how can we take best practice from different parts of the country and spread that more widely and use that together to come up with the sort of, I suppose, perfect eye care pathway. So for me, what I really am focusing on now is to try and take all that learning, to try and take a collaborative approach where we look at the pathway from end to end. So how do we look at the right from the point of information and prevention all the way through to diagnosis, to treatment, to discharge, to community support? How do we link that all so that from the patient perspective, it becomes a seamless journey where they don't feel that they're at a number of different gateways as they go from either their GP or their optometrist into hospital eye care service and back out again? How do we make that feel like one journey rather than lots of little, divided up pieces of work? So for me, that's where I really want to focus the attention. But recognizing that we're in a challenging situation financially, we're in a challenging situation in terms of the number of patients waiting for treatment, and that actually we know we need to transform eye care if we're going to address that. And that transformation cannot be done by any one sector by its own. It has to be a collaborative approach with the community sectors, with the charitable sectors, and with the NHS to pull together to produce something that we all feel proud of.
Louisa Wickham, National Clinical Director for Eye Care. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Goodbye.